in many ways, and I think we all can in some ways, because I look at some of the challenges that he faced, and I look at some of the choices he made, and it's easy to identify with some of what must have been going on in his mind, and yet, in spite of some of the things that he did incorrectly, he turned his life back to God, despite the poor choices he had made in some occasions. So, in part, I think we can all identify with some of his struggles, but also with some very strong characteristics in this man. And it's for lessons of a personal nature I picked the subject, because I like the character. And I think there's a lot to learn from a personal perspective, which is why I just tacked on a man to remember, because it takes a lot more than a Bible class to deal with someone of whom there's quite a bit said. So that's just one aspect that I'd like to look at tonight for the few minutes we have together. So when we stop looking at a king of Israel from our own perspective and try to imagine how God must look at one of his kings in Israel, from what we are told about the character of God, what would we see? Well, we don't have a lot of guessing to do, because interestingly enough, it's in Deuteronomy, and we won't go there, but Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 to 20, gives us a perspective on how God looks, what God looks for in the kings that would, he knew, come upon the throne of Israel. And in that passage, the point that he brings out clearly to me is that kings should be servants and shepherds of God's people, fulfilling a role. And the gist of that passage says that kings should not be empire builders to themselves. They should not be looking upon the power as something that they deserve and that they almost usurp. And in God's view, it's very clear that a king was a leader of his people. And most important, that king was a servant to him. And we read about several instances like that. For instance, we just read in our readings about Solomon. And when God said to Solomon, "Solomon, you can have anything you wish." And Solomon turned to God and asked him for wisdom and understanding and knowledge. God appreciated what Solomon had said. Not because he was very adept and very smart, but because he chose it for a good reason, because he realized that his role was servant of the Most High God, and he had a responsibility to be shepherd to this great people, as he said. And so God says, not only will you have that, I'll give you everything else as well. And really, it's not too dissimilar in our own lives, not that we put ourselves in the place of a king, but our lives are also very much about service, regardless of our station, regardless of who we are. They're about service. And so what I'd like to do is five topics to pick out of Jehoshaphat's life tonight. The first one, I'm just going to give a brief overview. A second one is the alliances and relationships he made. A third is leadership. The fourth is operating under pressure. And the fifth, the power of prayer. Now, a brief overview, just to establish a few things and to make a few comments relative to some of the other comments I will make shortly. The land of Israel and Judah at the time, just prior to Jehoshaphat, was rather an interesting one, in that Israel had been in a state of upheaval, in tumultuous array, as has been described, for a period of over 40 years. Judah had fared an awful lot better over those 40 years. In fact, they had fared very well, because they're under the reign of Asa, king of Judah, who was Jehoshaphat's father. And why did they fare very well? Because Asa was what is commonly understood as a good king. And I'm not going to have to, I don't have to explain myself on good. I think you understand what I'm saying. Asa turned to God, and he helped turn the people to God, and God prospered his reign. So what happens is that Asa reigned for about 41 years. And during that period was a very, very good period in Israel's history. Contrarywise, in the land of Israel, there wasn't a good king to be seen. In fact, there were 8 kings. Some of them only lasted a very short period of time, obviously. So during the reign of one king in Judah, we had 8 kings in Israel. And they are very wicked kings. And during that period in Israel, there were periods where they had basically civil war. So there's a lot of unrest until the last king of those 8, which we're all familiar with, Ahab. Now the interesting thing about Ahab is, although he was very, very wicked, he also controlled Israel much better than his 7 predecessors. And in fact, the other ones lived very short lives and had very short reigns. Ahab managed to stay alive for 22 years, which is the longest for a long time in Israel. So I point that out because one thing Ahab did do is stabilize Israel somewhat. And he managed to stay alive, like I said. He was a builder and he fortified cities. And as wicked as he was, and with the help of his wife, he even pointed religion in a single direction. It was a wrong direction, but he unified the people in that wrong direction. So from a period of time prior to Ahab that was about as stable as water, as the saying goes, the time when Ahab reigns, there is a bit of a change in Israel. They're still very, very wicked, but there's a stability there. It was due to the reforms that Asa had invoked in Judah that the people of Judah had a change of heart from a way not too dissimilar from Israel prior to that. And it says that Judah swore an oath to service to God wholeheartedly. And it says that they sought God eagerly, and he was found by them, and the Lord gave them rest on every side. And Asa espoused God in his own life, and it looks like the people followed what he did. Because it says, Asa's heart was fully committed to the Lord all his life. So when Jehoshaphat comes to reign, he has a foundation to build on. You could say he had a head start. And when he came to reign, Ahab was still king in Israel. And when Jehoshaphat came to reign, he was 35 years old, a little more mature than a lot of the kings who came to the thrones. A lot were younger than that. He reigned for about 25 years, so he died about the age of 60. And when we think about who this king was and what was going on in these two neighboring countries who were really brethren from an earlier age, it helps us to put in perspective some of the things that perhaps, or some of the reasons maybe that Jehoshaphat said and did what he did. But in any case, it appears that Jehoshaphat was a king who saw his role as one of a shepherd in Israel. And under Jehoshaphat, we see even further spiritual reform. So one of the things that is obviously very big in this man's life is, in terms of factors that we could characterize his life by, in one respect, is the alliances, the relationships that he had and made. And it's one of the challenges that he faced in his life. And we have at least 4 that are recorded for us. And I'm just going to note quickly those 4. The first one was with Ahab. This is when Ahab spoke to Jehoshaphat and said, "Will you go out with me to fight?" Well, why did he make this alliance with Ahab? Well, he made the alliance with Ahab to retrieve Israelite land, to retrieve Ramoth-Gilead from Syria. That's why he did it. He made an alliance between Israel and Judah in another way, too. He did it from a familial way. The royal families were united in that his son Joram, or Jehoram, they're both the same name, married Athaliah, again, a wicked daughter of Ahab. Why did he do that? Well, I'm sure he didn't think, well, I'm going to let my son marry this wicked person. Perhaps it was for the diplomatic relationship with Israel, which before had been a very threatening neighbor to Judah. And there had been a lot of difficulty between these two nations, as they, well, really one nation, but divided in two parts. The next one he makes is with Ahaziah, Ahab's son and successor. And with Ahaziah, why did he make a league with him? Well, in that case, it was an economic venture. It was that time when they built trading ships. You could call it an international shipping trade. And we know what God thought of that, because before they even set sail, he caused them to be destroyed. And then another brother of Ahab who succeeded Ahaziah, Jehoram, and we'll notice that both Jehoshaphat and Ahab both have sons called Jehoram or Joram. Why did he make that one? Well, he made an agreement with him to address a common threat that they had at the time, and that was the threat of the Moabites. The Moabites were put down and controlled under Ahab's reign, but under his son's reign, they rebelled. So those are what the things that he did. And I would suggest that these are things that any king would normally do, both to secure peace for his people and to encourage economic growth. And it would seem that each of the alliances had a reason why a king would possibly make such an alliance. And it's impossible to try to know what exactly Jehoshaphat was thinking when he did these things. Perhaps he was thinking about the reunification of Israel and Judah, because maybe he looked upon it as the best time that they had seen in 40 years to have some kind of influence to reunify God's people as one nation once again. Perhaps it was that. Perhaps he saw how he could influence his own people and thought, just maybe he could influence Ahab. Maybe. There's a very short verse in 1 Kings 22, verse 44, and all it says is, Jehoshaphat was also at peace with the king of Israel. Now, that was not easy. That was not easy. It took maintenance. And maybe, like I said, it's a little hard for us to sit in the armchair of the critic a few thousand years later and try to understand everything that went through his mind. And of course we can't. But all I can say with that is there were some reasons why someone might do that. But no matter how we speculate, no matter what we say, the problem is that these alliances were seen in a very bad way. There's nothing wrong with, I shouldn't say that. It's not so much that he made the alliances, and it's not so much the reason why he made the alliances. It's who he made the alliances with. And maybe it was to promote peace or join forces against those who despise the Lord God Almighty. In any case, they were wicked people that he sought alliances with in every case, and they were all either Ahab or his family. And God let Jehoshaphat know what he thought about this. And it was interesting to me when I was reading through him, I realized that on the what appears to be three occasions where God sent a prophet to Jehoshaphat to tell him what he thought, or where a prophet of God was involved, it looks like God was trying from a different perspective in each case, because there were three different prophets. Actually, I guess there was four, because there was Micaiah who told Jehoshaphat, no, don't go up against Syria with Ahab. Don't do that. Actually, that's not quite right. Yeah, it is. There's Jehu the seer also, who commented after Micaiah had said that. When he came back, Jehu the seer was sent to him to say, "The wrath of the Lord is upon you," 2 Chronicles 19:1-2. And it was why? Because he fought with Ahab against Syria. And he goes on to say, was it not for the good that the Lord saw in you, you would have been wiped out. You would have been destroyed. And in 2 Chronicles 20:37, Eliezer is sent to talk to Jehoshaphat, and he said, "Because you made an alliance with Ahaziah, the Lord has destroyed what you made." That was the sailing ships, the trading ships. In 2 Kings 3:14, God's conclusion of another matter is through Elisha. And this is regarding his alliance to fight against Moab, combining forces. And at this particular time, they could have been wiped out. And Elisha is sent to him, and he said, "Both of you, Israel and Judah, would have been wiped out had it not been for you, Jehoshaphat." And he says that God had respect for him. So the question comes back to us when it comes to the alliances that he makes and the mistakes that he makes in these. What do we take from a man who obviously God acknowledged, obviously God cared about? What do we take from it? The fact that he made these unfortunate alliances. Well, there's probably lots of things, but just a couple of things. Obviously, we're not being told that we shouldn't ever make agreements, because that's a part of life. But perhaps what we can see in the examples where Jehoshaphat made agreements and alliances, that we do well to think about the ones that we do make and consider how God might look at the things that we do, whether we make some that are perhaps unnecessary. Maybe some of the things that we do and agree to do could adversely affect our walk before God, could become a problem for us to fulfill without compromising our walk before our God. Perhaps they take us down a path from which it's very hard to retract. When he went to Ahab, and Ahab says, "Will you join with me to fight and to restore my land?" And what did Jehu say? What did Jehoshaphat say? He said, "My people are as your people. My horses as your horses." And that was an unwise thing to say right away. And although he did say right after that something that was very brave, he said, "But first we must inquire the Lord." And Ahab says, "Well, I have 400 prophets here, and they all say the same thing. We should do it." And he still persists. He says, no, I'm not willing to accept that in essence. I want a prophet of God. Isn't there one here?" And they bring Micaiah, and Micaiah, to cut it short, in the end says, "No, if you return, Ahab, then the Lord has not spoken through me." And you'd think, oh, that's the clear message to Jehoshaphat. There's his out. I'm sorry, Ahab, but the prophet of the Lord says this, so I can't do it. I don't know what possessed him, and I'm careful about judging him, but why did he then turn around and go with Ahab? And maybe it is because there was a little bit too much give and take in his own life, with Ahab particularly. Maybe it was because he felt committed from the first words out of his mouth, that even when he tried to get around it, he couldn't quite bring himself to turn his back on Ahab after saying, "My people is your people, my horses is your people." Sometimes it's very hard to retract words that we say quickly, to change things when we have started on the wrong foot. So it's a lesson to us to be very cautious, because we're not living for ourselves. We are living for God. We are living a life of service. And sometimes it's a very good idea in those kind of situations to sidestep. And I don't mean be tricky. I mean simply say, "I need some time to think about that," or some such, or "I'll get back to you," or something like that, because a number of times Jehoshaphat was too quick off the mark. But one of the most encouraging things out of these situations is what happens in the end result. and a very positive thing. Despite Jehoshaphat's bad choice, for instance, when he went to battle with Ahab, what happened? What happened? He agreed to Ahab's plan, ignored God's warning through Micaiah, and what happens? God forgives him and does not punish him with death, the death he deserved, the death we all deserve. When he knew that his life was in grave danger, when they were closing in on him, expecting that he was the king of Israel, he knew if he didn't cry out to God, there was no other help. And he cried out to God. He turned to God. He didn't try to fix it himself. He cried out to God, and God heard him. And he picked him up, and he helped him. And the question is why? Because that's important for every one of us to ask. Because it's why we believe what we believe, and it's the God that we believe. And if we don't understand this, I don't know how we can serve our God. I would suggest to you that God saved him in that mistake that he made, because his usual tendency in his life was a faithful one. His usual direction was God's way. And when our hearts are in the right direction, God forgives and saves. And he schools those he loves. And he invests in those who are trying to serve him. And I see Psalm 66 verse 18, a very well known verse, as being exactly Jehoshaphat in that instance. NIV puts it quite nicely, I think. It says, if I had cherished sin in my heart, if that's what I really wanted, if that's what I was after, if I cherished sin in my heart, the Lord would not have listened. But God surely listened. He heard the voice of my prayer. Praise be to God who has not rejected my prayer or withheld his love from me. Jehoshaphat obviously didn't write it, but it is that situation. And this is where I go sometimes to have the courage to keep going. It's records like this that say, if my true desire is to serve my God, he's there to turn to. And when I make those mistakes like Jehoshaphat, if I cry to him and it's his will, he can and will pick me up out of that and deliver me from that. And I think we can say that to ourselves. That's why he was I. Because we say this to ourselves. Because that's what God did miraculously. He reached out and he saves him. So we get verses like, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, and his ear is not stopped that it cannot hear, or heavy that it cannot hear. I can love a God who hears his failing servant. I know that that's something I can do. And I know that's something that you can do. He reaches out and he works in our lives. And one assurance of that, which I think is a fact, is Jehoshaphat. It reminds me of so many different things, but one of them is in the last hymn that we're going to sing this evening. Yet I may love thee too, O Lord, almighty as thou art. For thou hast stooped to ask of me the love of my poor heart. Again, it's a strong message. So out of those trials came a man who turned back to God. Leadership. It seems to me that he led by example and by action. And I was reminded of something that Brother Gordon said a few months ago when he said something along the lines of, God is not interested in religious people. He's interested in a relationship. What we do in terms of observance and obedience is only useful when our heart is right. That's what I take from that. When it comes to leadership, that is ever so more the truth. And in this case of a king is only truly believable when what he requires of his people is what he does himself. And this leadership, in my mind, in Jehoshaphat, comes from, amongst other things, these three things. That overall, his heart was right before God. That he acted on what he believed. And in leadership, influenced others. And he was in a position to do that. But he did it. And that's the point. And the people saw it. The people believed it. Because it was believable. And the people practiced it. And the best part is that God blessed the whole nation for it. And that's what we see in these verses. 2 Chronicles 17:3-4, and I'm just going to bring a few things out of it. You can turn there if you like, but you don't need to. It says, "And the Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the ways of his father David, and sought not unto Balaam, and sought the Lord, the God of his father, and walked in his commandments, and not after the doings of Israel." Now, a number of kings in Israel and Judah for a little while did a few things God's way. And they said they did this. But there was also something on the other side that they didn't do. Some kings did one thing and not the other. Jehoshaphat, it's interesting, he does both. He walked in the ways of God, and he did not walk in the ways of Balaam. He sought the God of his fathers and did not the things of Israel, a wicked nation at that time. So he was a man of personal action and dedication. Even Solomon got caught in this. So he did the things of God, but he allowed other things. He didn't put away the things of Balaam, basically, or maybe not the things of Balaam, but things contrary to God. So another thing is, that's what he did for himself. And in essence, that extended to the nation. But there's other things he did explicitly for the nation of whom he was king. In 2 Chronicles 17:6-9, it says, "And his heart was lifted up," and you think, this is a bad sign. Most kings, when it says heart is lifted up, it's to do evil. Not this time. "Lifted up in the ways of the Lord. Moreover, he took away the high places and the groves out of Judah. Also, in the third year of his reign, he sent to his princes, even two," and it names them all. And what did he send them to do? "To teach in the cities of Judah. And with them, he sent Levites," and it names the Levites. And it says, "And with them, he sent priests," and it names the priests. And what did they do? "They taught in Judah and had the book of the law of the Lord with them and went throughout the cities of Judah and taught the people." Now that is an amazing thing. He had a conviction and a determination, and he wanted it to share this with the people. A number of kings, when they wanted something, they commanded it. And they made it a law, and they dictated it. Jehoshaphat didn't. He taught it. He educated the people. And not only that, he demonstrated it in his own life so they could see what that looked like. And that was really, really important. And what did he do? Well, if you look at them, there's about 16 of them, I think. The prophets, the Levites, the princes, the Levites, and the priests. And it's just like a school of 16 mature Truth Corps people going around throughout, as it says, all the cities of the nation, teaching and educating. An active way to reform. And I may be wrong, but I can't remember another king, either before or after him, who did that kind of thing. I believe this was something new. It definitely wasn't done before him in that manner, where he sent this group around to all these cities in Judah. And I don't think it was after. It was quite a commitment. The result, well, we see it when there's trouble. The people all come in unison before the Lord. It's not just Jehoshaphat. It's all the people, and they call upon God. Two other verses. 2 Chronicles 19:4 says, this is two chapters later from the last one we looked at. It says, "And Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem, and he went out again throughout the people from Beersheba to Ephraim and brought them back to the Lord God of their fathers." Now, why do I mention that? It's the persistence. He didn't just do it once and say, "Yep, I think I've done it now." He went again. I don't know what the time period is between these two events. It's two chapters in the Bible, but I have no idea what the time frame is. The point is, he did it more than once. It wasn't a one-off, and God blessed him for it. But not only did God bless him, he blessed the whole nation. 2 Chronicles 19:5-9, he went one more step, and that is, he set judges in the land. because a nation is a lot of people. And he wanted to try to ensure that this structure was maintained, that the integrity of the nation was there, and he knew he couldn't do it all by himself, just like Jethro told Moses. So what did he do? He set up the judges, and he says, look, you're not judging for men, but for the Lord, and he will be with you in judgment. Wherefore now, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take heed and do it. For there is no iniquity with the Lord, or respect of persons, or taking a gift, no bribes. So he, in the end, he says, so don't you do that, because you're representatives of God. And this is what you shall do. So a structure was being maintained there within the nation. What head of state in your memory can you think of that told the people there's no iniquity with the Lord our God, so don't you do that? What leader has said you should not have respect to persons, because that's what God doesn't have respect to persons, and no bribes, and no this, and no that. It doesn't happen. He had a devotion to God that did something very important. It extended to the people of God. And it had the potential to promote personal spiritual growth. And that's what's alive, and that's what keeps it going. It wasn't a command. It wasn't because they had to. It was a personal growth in the whole nation. And that is absolutely amazing, and that is leadership. And what I would suggest, no, what I would say is that this applies to absolutely every one of us, no matter who we are, what our talents are. We all have a leadership role. And in that respect, I would say, it's because we all have the opportunity to do things, to react in a number of different ways. We all have options we can exercise every single day. And I'm not saying that we walk up to everybody we see and open our Bibles and start preaching to them. What I'm saying is the way we behave. The example that speaks more than words. The example of this man, Jehoshaphat, who lived a life consistent with God. And that's really what we're trying to do. Live a life consistent with the way God would want a servant of his to live. And we can show leadership by the things we choose not to do, as well as by the things we choose to do and to say. And it can be something as mundane as the way we treat a sales clerk in a store. We have an option. We can treat them a number of different ways. We can treat them with a measure of respect, even though we may feel it's undeserved. We can be pleasant and courteous, or we can treat them with indifference. It's a choice we have. It's all our options. We can do whatever we like. So we have an obligation before God to make it as consistent as we can with a servant of the Most High God, because we are, by doing this, fulfilling a leadership role in that we are teaching a better way. And we will be blessed if we do this, because it's God's way, it's not ours. So, obviously, it extends to far more important things than clerks in a store. Not that that's unimportant, but that's the point. Operating under pressure, I'm going to have to skip through most of this one, but suffice it to say that I'm going to use a little bit of this because it leads into my last point about the power of prayer, and I'd like to spend just a few minutes with that. And it's the reading that we had tonight in 2 Chronicles 20, because this one really, really strikes me. We're told there's three groups of people that come against him, unprovoked. It says in verse 2, some men came and told Jehoshaphat, a vast army is coming against you. And the NIV says alarmed. King James says he was afraid. A vast army. Now, what is the first thing most kings do that we read? Well, one of the things, they sort of figure out, well, how many are they and how many do I have? And does this make sense? Oh, I better go and grab somebody else to help me form an allegiance so that I can survive the situation. And they count their armed people. They organize their army. They do any one of a number of things. Jehoshaphat does not. Jehoshaphat does a few things. First of all, verse 3, he turns to God. He resolved, he decided to inquire of the Lord. Then, second thing he does, he proclaims a fast for all of Judah. And in verse 4, the whole nation basically, or representatives from the whole nation at least, assembles to seek God's help. Now, they didn't do that because they were commanded to. It was what they understood was right. I'm sure that it was their convictions that led them to do this, not simply Jehoshaphat. And what does he do? Well, he stands up in front of the assembly and prays in verses 6 to 12. And that's a lesson for the people in itself. And cut this one short a little bit. The bottom line is, because this is what Jehoshaphat chose to do when he had other options, and because the people chose to do this, and they may have felt they had other options, God blessed them. And he sends his prophet to tell them, look, I've heard your prayer. The battle is not yours, but God's. He took it on himself. He says, I will look after you. You showed me honor, and I will look after you. And he says, not only that, you won't even have to fight. And they believed him. Because when they do eventually go out, he doesn't put his commanders in front and all his brave warriors. You know who he has in front? You probably noticed it in the reading. A choir, praising God. You think, well, that's faith. They really did believe that this is how it was going to be. And they praised God. They didn't forget why. They didn't take it upon themselves, but they praised God. And I would call that follow through. But that leads up to the prayer that I'd like to talk about. The power of prayer is the last thing I'd like to leave with you, because it's incredible, because it's the power that is open to every one of us. Jehoshaphat was a man of prayer a number of times. This is only one of them. And you can look back and you can see a few of the other ones, but this is the one I want to deal with at the moment. And facing this army and being afraid, or being, I'm not sure what the Hebrew word is best translated in English, alarmed, whatever it may be, it just makes me think this. Is it not true for you that the things most likely, or one of the things most likely to drive us to our knees in prayer, is fear? It might be fear of losing someone. It might be fear of a particular situation. It might be fear of a particular person. It might be fear of losing your own faith. It might be fear that you're not being heard. It might be fear of a number of different things. But when the waters of life are calm, and the way I would see it, sort of the rhythm of daily life appears manageable, we are possibly likely to confess that our compulsion to call upon the Lord is diminished a little bit. It's the natural way our human mind thinks. At least that's what my human mind thinks. And even at sometimes we may even find the compulsion to call upon God absent. But when we are faced with difficulties and fear, that's when the believer comes to their knees in prayer before God. We're irresistibly drawn before God because we know there is no other place to go for help. So Jehoshaphat was afraid, we are told, and he turned his attention to the Lord. And I would suggest to you, it's not wrong to be afraid. A lot of faithful people were afraid. It is a natural emotion that we have. And perhaps the more our faith grows, the less afraid we become. And we see some who face things and we think they should be afraid and didn't appear to be, because their faith was such that it conquered it. But to be afraid is not wrong. It's what we do when we are afraid that makes all the difference in the world. And that's what we see here. He was afraid, and what did he do? He turned his attention to seek the Lord, the King James says. And we look at his prayer in verses 6 through 12. We see three basic principles in his prayer There may be more, but these are the ones I saw anyway. He initiates praise, first thing he does. He then identifies the problem, and then he implores God. He asks God for help. And it's interesting how this works, because when he initiates praise, he's acknowledging God. Just like we've been talking about, the number one thing isn't how things affect us. The number one thing is God and his glory and his honor. And that's who he acknowledged. He acknowledged God first. And he says, "Art thou not the ruler over the kingdom of the nations? Power and might are in your hand, so that no one can stand against you." That's who you are. I understand that. I know who you are, O Lord. You've delivered me before, and I know you have the power to do that again. But this is who you are. And he brings praise before him. And he praises his attributes, that you drove out the inhabitants of the land. You're a mighty God. You gave it to the descendants of Abraham, who is your friend forever. That's who you are, verse 7. So he doesn't forget that the primary importance is God. And that's his perspective. It's not a complaint that comes out first. It's not, oh, help me. It's acknowledging who he is coming before. And then when it comes to the problem, he identifies it. And he identifies it two ways, really. He identifies the external problem. And he says, basically, I have these people who have come against me. That's the problem outside what I can do anything about. That's the external problem. And that's what's facing me. God knew, but this is how he did it. Then he identifies the internal problem. What do you mean, the internal problem? Well, very much an internal problem, because this is what's in his control. We are powerless before this great multitude who are coming against us. Nor do we know what to do. It's within his power to do what? To turn it to God. Nor do we know what to do. The shepherd of God's people speaking, not a king who was an empire builder, who reveled in his own glory. He confesses his total inability to know what to do. And the last step, he implores God. And it's interesting how he does it. He says, we have no power in verse 12, the end of the verse, to face this vast army that's attacking us. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are upon you. And in English, to me, that means we're leaving it in your hands. Here's our problem. Thy will be done. I'm leaving it to you, O Lord. I'm leaving it in your hands. And that's it. And the Lord delivered them, just like we have already considered. But he didn't just deliver them. He did it in a miraculous fashion. And they didn't even have to fight. How many battles would we not have to fight if perhaps we had taken them to the Lord just a little bit earlier and maybe asked for instruction and believed that we would get it? And I think we may have had experiences ourselves where we have got that instruction. And it is an encouraging thing. So we're left with examples like this to turn to, of people who turn to their God and his hand is seen in their lives, whether it be out of fear or out of trouble, or whether it is in times of comfort and blessing. Our challenge is to remember those like Jehoshaphat, who chose to seek God while he may be found, who chose to call upon him when he was near, to take that and translate it into our own lives, to allow these thoughts, promote these thoughts to make a difference in our lives. How? In a way that is consistent with the servant of the Most High God.